Hello, this is Monica Reeds and I'm Georgina Godwin. We're in the midst of a series of programmes looking ahead to Hay Festival, one of the biggest and best literary events in the world. It's taken place annually since 1987, and this year it'll be online from the 26th of May to the 6th of June, broadcasting the world's greatest writers and thinkers for free from Hay-on-Wye, the small town on the border of Wales. And Monica Reeds and Meet the Writers will be there, bringing you highlights from the festival and interviews with the participants. Now, Lem Sisay is a BAFTA-nominated international prize-winning writer. He was awarded an MBE for services to literature, the Penn Pinter Prize and a Points of Light Award from the Prime Minister. His memoir, My Name is Why, is published by Canongate. Now, Lem has curated a series of events for Hay Festival on the theme George Floyd, one year on. Lem, thanks so much for talking to us. Why is it important to revisit this topic?
Well, it feels very current at this moment in time that the George Floyd's death has allowed us to be able to focus on the issues that have been raised by Black Lives Matter throughout the pandemic. So the world is changing around us, has been for a while, but I think what happened with George Floyd is that the issue became above the crease, as it was once known. It became part of public consciousness.
And it's global. I mean, George Floyd was American, but this is still relevant to Britain.
Yes, it is. I was thinking about this the other day, and a person might ask, well, that happened in America. It didn't happen in England. But the world is a lot smaller now. We're able to exchange information and see correlation between institutional racism and us, the public.
What do we do about it, though? I mean, there's so much that still needs to be done to battle racism. And does anybody have the answer of how we get there?
The first thing that we all need to do is talk openly, honestly, and with detail. And we need to listen to the best minds of our generations to see what they feel about this issue. And that's why I curated this series of conversations at Hay.
Well, tell us about the events that you've programmed. What are they and why did you choose those particular people and subjects?
Every single individual in the George Floyd series curated by myself is somebody I respect, somebody I love hearing speak. For example, the first event is when Bonnie met Ash. Ash Sarkar is a live wire. I mean, she's incredible as a journalist and as a speaker. And she's going to be speaking with Bonnie Greer about the difference between the time of the 60s and the 70s and Black consciousness, as it was known then, and what's happening now with Black Lives Matter. It's no longer a side issue. You know, this strikes right at the heart of what it is to be a citizen in Britain today. Mm. So I'm looking forward to that. You know, Marza Mengista, the Ethiopian Booker shortlisted writer, and Ida Edemariam, who is a journalist for The Guardian, but who wrote a brilliant book called The Wife's Tale. Both of them are from Ethiopia. They're around a similar age. And both of them have written books about women in Ethiopia and their role in the family and in politics and in battle. And that's not been done before. And they've wrote their books within 2 or 3 years of each other. So I'm asked, their talk is going to be who is telling the story. So that's going to be fascinating for me. Hannah Aziebpool, an Eritrean writer, which is next to Ethiopia, and British journalist and head of the Bernie Grant Arts Centre, and Nadia Owusu, both of them are going to be speaking about the memoir, something which is obviously close to my heart as well.
Of course, because your memoir is just fantastic. Your memoir, of course, My Name is Why. Really interesting that all of the people you've chosen are women.
It was the first decision I made when I was asked to curate the series. So we started with that criteria.
Mm-hmm. Len, what do you want audiences to take away from these sessions?
Firstly, I want them to enjoy them, to listen to two intelligent, critical and contemporary minds. I want them to enjoy that, where those creatives will go with the subject. That's really important. Like any Hay event, it's enjoyment is high up on the list, right? And I want people to come away feeling better about the world, feeling more that they understand the world just a little bit more by listening to these speakers, really.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks.
We can turn to Ash now, a senior editor at Navarra Media. She's a political commentator and an activist. In 2018, The Times dubbed her the poster girl for the radical left. Ash, you'll be in conversation with Bonnie Greer, as Lem says. Now, Bonnie's from an older generation of activists and writers. Do you think that the battles you're fighting now are different from the ones spearheaded by Bonnie at the beginning of her career?
Well, I think we can see some of them as a continuation. You see a lot of young people today turning back to older political traditions, the Black Panthers, the feminist movement, even the early environmental and ecology movement, in order to learn from different kinds of organizing models. So I think that there's always this element of tradition and continuity. But I think the nature of the beast has changed. I think that class composition, particularly in Britain and America, has changed an awful lot. So you're stuck in this weird place where the left behind are being defined as retired homeowners and temps who are precariously employed working in data entry and spending half of their salary on extortionate rents are being classed as metropolitan elites. And I think that that particular sleight of hand is new and forces us to consider ourselves politically in different ways.
I wonder how the murder of George Floyd has changed the narrative. I mean, because obviously there have been high profile, appalling killings before.
Well, it's interesting to see Black Lives Matter not as a single movement, but as a movement which has had two or three lives, even. The first sort of blossoming after the acquittal of George Zimmerman. And at that point, Black Lives Matter was intended by its founders as being a kind of love note to the Black community. So it really emerged as a cri de coeur. And then with Michael Brown and Ferguson, you see the anger, you see the rage, and it's a legitimate one. It's one that's born of, I guess, a howl of anguish that emerges from seeing someone who looks like he could be your kid brother, you know, gunned down in the street by a police officer. And then with George Floyd, of course, there have been murders like that before. You had Eric Garner, whose last words were the same as George Floyd's. But I think that it was the accumulation of the uprisings that had come before, the fact that George Floyd's last words were a repetition of Eric Garner's, plus the horrendous nature of the footage where anyone who watched it saw somebody being murdered in front of them over the course of 8 minutes, that couldn't help but spark off the movement and the uprising and the backlash that it did. And I think those images had international salience because even though they came from this very American context, it provided almost this kind of emotional resonance which forced people to confront and acknowledge the way in which that was playing out in their own communities as well.
And of course, the digital age must have changed things. We're all so much more aware and so much more interconnected. You've been absolutely vilified online. How has that informed your experience?
You know what? It's one of those Rudyard Kipling things of you get extreme hatred and extreme adulation on social media, and it's best to treat both imposters just the same. Don't take it too seriously. But it does speak to, I think, something which is out there, which is the way in which politics now is a culture war. And that means that everybody's polarized on matters of identity and different positions are literally embodied by different individuals. And whether I like it or not, because I don't see my own politics in that way, you know, I'm an old school vulgar Marxist, for God's sake, but I'm still being positioned as woke, metropolitan elite. She's brown, she's Muslim, she's left wing. She wants all these new, you know, impronounceable gender pronouns. And when you are seen to embody that, it's like you're a lightning rod for all of the political forces which stand opposed to that constellation of politics. And so that's what it means to be on social media in the kind of position that I'm in. I think it's revealing about politics, but if you let it tell you too much about yourself, you'll go insane.
I'm surprised to hear you quote Kipling. Of course, he's famously, you know, known for his very colonial works. And nowadays, somebody like that would be cancelled, as indeed Julie Birchall has been. And people can look this up. You had a very well-publicised attack from her on you, and consequently her publishers cancelled her book. Do you think that cancelling people, like we might do to Kipling if he were alive today, is the answer?
I've really got to push back against your framing. What happened with Julie Birchall had nothing to do with me. It had nothing to do with me. I was there sitting, minding my own business, tweeting about something else, and she launched an attack on me on the basis of my religion and on the basis of my gender and on the basis of my race. She made defamatory comments, which she has subsequently had to apologize for and pay damages for, and which she has had to retract. And so the fact that this is being cast as an issue of cancel culture, I've really got to object to that in the strongest possible terms. The only reason why it's being understood as cancel culture, rather than, say, a barrage of racist invective targeted at a fellow journalist, is because the optics show you young woman of color on the left and older person who is more aligned with a reactionary point of view. But it has nothing to do with cancel culture whatsoever.
I apologize. I think I was trying to oversimplify that. But could we drill down a little bit into cancel culture? Is it right that people are just never heard from again?
But I think we hear an awful lot from Rudyard Kipling. We hear an awful lot from Julie Birchall, for that matter. Mm. We hear an awful lot from these people who proclaim themselves or proclaim others to be so-called cancelled. So what's going on here? Is this really an assault on freedom of speech itself, which I'm a journalist. I take freedom of speech and freedom of expression very seriously. Mm. I'm an Article 10 evangelist. Or is this actually a lot of people in the publishing industry reacting badly to the fact that the emergence of the digital sphere means that it's no longer one-way publication, you're broadcast only. Sometimes you've got to hear what people think of you as well. Mm. And being subject to that kind of intense criticism, I know from experience, it's not fun. But hey, that's the marketplace of ideas.
No, absolutely. Do you think then that social media can be a force for good?
Can social media be a force for good? You know what? I think it's warped my brain so much that I can only say yes. I think social media can do terrible things. So I think it can do great things. I think social media can connect people with life experiences, subjectivities, places, spaces, cultures that they would never have once had access to. And that's wonderful. I think the other thing that it can do is create a hyper conflict driven polarized environment where you are careening from one conflict into another that you almost forget what it is you're fighting for in the first place. I think that kind of immersion in social media can be very disorientating. And so if you go, well, what would a healthy relationship to social media look like? I have no idea. I've got over 300,000 followers on Twitter, and you don't get that by having a healthy relationship with that platform.
Do you think then that racism is something that is possibly inherent in everyone?
What I would say is that racism emerged out of particular economic, social, and historical forces. Because before, I would argue, the 15th century, 1492 is one of the key dates, I would say, because you've got Christopher Columbus heading westwards, but also the expulsion of the Jews from the Iberian Peninsula. Before that, you don't really have a hierarchy of race. people think of civilizational differences, religious differences, differences in language and cultural practice, but there isn't this idea that you can transmit culture hereditarily. Mm. Really, that emerges in the 15th century, and then onwards, you've got the expulsion of the Moriscos from Spain, the purported expulsion of the Moors from England by Elizabeth I, you've got the transatlantic slave trade, you've got the conquest of Latin America, and you've got the expansion of the Ottoman Empire westwards, which is sort of driving all of these things as well. And it's around that time that you get not only the invention of race as a way of organizing the human species, a way of organizing society and governance, but also at the same time, racism. So these two inventions, race and racism, happen at exactly the same time.
And I guess there's a lot about power there, isn't there then?
Oh yeah, 100% to do with power. So of course that is in all of us. It affects all of our worldviews because everyone on this planet has in some way been shaped by those historical forces. But I don't think that racism, the attachment of social hierarchy of value of life according to different kinds of racial phenotypes, is inherent to the human condition. I think it's a product of human culture, and that means we can change it.
And do you think that those who aren't on the receiving end of it understand what it's like? I mean, there's lots of mea culpa coming from white people, for instance. You know, is that genuine?
Well, put it this way. My stepdad, who I adore, is white British. My partner is white British as well. And while they can't understand what it's like to be in my shoes and to look out from my eyes and to live in my skin, through love, affection, and close contact, sharing our lives together, they do have a deeper understanding of what it means to experience racism because they've had to share a life with me. Mm. And so I think that one of the things that we can forget when we have a hyper-essentialized discourse where we go, here's your lived experience and here's my lived experience and never the twain shall meet, is that people live mixed lives in which we have to come to understandings of who we are and what shapes us. And I think that that is a really good starting place from which to build a project of solidarity in the face of oppression. So it's not me saying to my stepdad or to my partner, you're not me, which means you can never understand me. It's saying, well, look, we move in spaces together. We are treated differently in those spaces. Let's think about why, and let's think about how we can support each other through that.
And you can share family stories.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's the beautiful thing. I'm not a nationalist, right? I am not in that nationalist tradition of entirely separate and segregated organizing, which emerges in a ethnically or racially homogenous community. That's not what I believe in. I believe in people being able to share lives and family stories and love and mischief together, and that being the seeds of the kind of political and social organization that you want to see in the world.
Ash Sarkar, thank you very much indeed. Well, those family stories are further debated in a session between Maza Mengistu, the author of the Booker Prize shortlisted novel The Shadow King, and Aida Edelmariam's Ondaatje Prize-winning biography of her grandmother, The Wife's Tale. Both books approach the history of the 20th century Ethiopia through female protagonists. And Maza joins me now. Maza, how important is your own family history in defining who you are now?
Oh, it is absolutely pivotal for me to understand who I am, both in the United States and, you know, every time I go back to Ethiopia. In Ethiopia, we learn our family history by learning all the names of people who came before us. It is my last name is my father's first name. And if I know his last name, I know my grandfather's first name. And if I know my grandfather's last name, I know my great-grandfather's name. So I learned my lineage, and it's something that I've carried with me since I was a child, but especially when I came to the United States. My name became very important, and my family became central to my identity.
And the family stories too, presumably.
Absolutely, Georgina. But you know, I came here to the United States as a result of the revolution in Ethiopia, and I immediately understood that there were some family stories that were forever shut away from me. I have, even now in my adult life, have been continuing to piece things together, and it's been revelatory and eye-opening.
Mm. In finding those stories, are you relying on the memories of others? And is it important whether those memories are reliable or not? Does the absolute truth matter? Or can a deeply felt memory, whether accurate or not, be just as meaningful?
Oh, I think that's a really good question. You're speaking to a novelist who has done a lot of work in historical archives. And when I go back to my family and ask them questions related to history, you know, this is oral history now that I'm collecting, I realize that those felt truths are as significant and as important as any data that I might pick up from a document, which itself could be biased. It just happens to be on paper.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, though, if the act of remembering can hold us back. I mean, should we be being dynamic and stepping forward? Or perhaps the two are not exclusive?
You know, I have been thinking lately about the benefits of leaving some memories aside, that maybe there are some things we don't need to carry forward. But I think we, especially with my family history, I'm dealing with things that need to be spoken, that are so deeply traumatic. And if they were shared, I think it might alleviate things. So I am for remembering, but I do think, and I've started to become much more nuanced and I think complicated my thinking about needing to unremember some things.
Mm. What would you like audiences to take away from your session at Hay?
My conversation with Aida was just, it was wonderful. I think it'll be, both of us have convergent and also different approaches to memory, to how we gathered our family stories. We have obstacles that we were able to share with each other and realize that they were very similar. But also the conversation was just so much fun. And talking about some of the convergences, some of the things that are just very Ethiopian, that maybe only we can, not that only we can understand, but we understood it in a way. And we share that with audiences in this conversation. And I hope that the audience will enjoy it. It was two women talking about other women in their family and realizing how much of a national history they contain.
And two women of colour, two women from Ethiopia. I mean, it's wrong, but that to find two women who had published such fantastic books on a worldwide event together, even 5 years ago, would have been unusual.
You're right. And we have come a long way in those years. I hope that we continue to push forward. These conversations should not be an anomaly. It should not be a special thing. It should just be so common that we have them and then continue to ask what next.
Mm. And finally, just to go back to the theme of this strand that's been curated by Lem Cissé, in remembering George Floyd, do you think that his murder has advanced the dialogue around Black Lives Matter? And has it affected your life?
I think that his murder has sent, it's not just a ripple effect, but it has been a seismic shift in the kinds of conversations the world is having. It is deeply unfortunate that it took a death out of many, many, many deaths. This is the one that seems to have galvanized the world. It has impacted me in the way that one more felt like too much. I have not yet been able to watch the video of his murder, but his absence, I think, has created conversations in this world that may not have happened. My only question now is, what do we do with those conversations to create real and lasting change? But it has made a huge impact on me, as the deaths of Breonna Taylor and Tamir Rice and Sandra Bland and so many others. It's overwhelming to think about, but it's made me consider how necessary all of our voices are in speaking out against injustice.
Maza, thank you so much. Maza Mengistu will be part of the Lem Sisay's George Floyd One Year On series at Hay Festival. And you can find out more and book for the digital sessions online at hayfestival.com. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, produced by Nora Hull and presented by me, Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.